The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Leeds.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist and happy holidays. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and I hope you are enjoying the 2 weeks you have before figuring out what you're going to do for gifts for people. If you're one of those wait till the last minute persons, the show tonight might be helpful to you. I wanted to start by sharing an update I received about Shelley Snyder today. It's all good. She's talking. She had her first ice cream this week. She's getting stronger and will soon be transferred out of the hospital to a special brain trauma rehab unit to continue the hard work on her road to recovery. It's a really good holiday gift for friends and family. I'd also like to let our listeners who hear the show on the air at 88.7 or stream live from the WJCU website that there is no air show Christmas Eve. Instead, there will be just a podcast. JCU usually puts on a really nice Christmas program, though, if you would like to listen to that. So on with the show, our first guest this evening is probably one of the most respected and classic frame builders in our business, Roland De La Santa. Roland's career spans many decades. His bikes reflect the classic style, grace, and beauty that make them so special to those who own and ride them. We'll learn about Roland's early career, see what he thinks about how the bike business has changed and morphed over the long span of his career, and ask him the usual questions about food and pets and music. We'll take a break for some news and then come back, and we will talk with senior tech editor at Bicycling Magazine, Gloria Liu. She not only reviews the products herself, she heads up a pretty large team that tests the hundreds of new bikes, accessories, and apparel that roll through the doors of magazine headquarters in Emmaus, PA each year. She's going to tell us everything in her wish list, from stocking stuffers to that one big item for the cyclists in your life. So let's head on out to the West Coast and talk with iconic frame builder Roland De La Santa. Hello, Roland. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week. How are you?
Okay.
That's good. Let's dive into your life and times. How about that?
Sure.
Okay. Give us a little background about yourself and how you became a frame builder.
Well, I was working in a bicycle shop after school, and the owner of the store was going to make his own frame, and it coincided with I was taking a metal shop, and I already had learned how to braze and work with metal and all that, so I kind of got involved with this project that took like 6 months, and that's kind of sparked my interest, but I didn't really get into the business until later, after I got out of the military, and I made my first frame in 1970. And between 1970 and 76, I kind of did it as a hobby, and I supplied some bike race friends with frames. And in 1976, I went full time, and so that was my life's job, constructing bike frames.
1976 was early on. Were you influenced by what was going on elsewhere in the world, or did you come up with your own style right away?
No, I was, because I had various race bikes, and my favorite bikes were always Italian. And at that time, Italy kind of ruled the world in, of bike racing as far as, you know, construction and equipment and technology and, you know, all that stuff. So my influence was kind of Italian race bikes. So I kind of gave it that, you know, that look, my decals and the finish and everything. So, and nothing's really changed over the past 35 years other than the newer materials.
Yeah, I would say that there are still people who believe that the bikes you built then are still the best bikes in the world.
I don't know about that.
But, well, I mean, in terms of the classic Italian racing style bicycle, people still love that feel of that bike under them.
Right, well, because they know how to build a frame and fork correctly to get the right balance. But as far as, oh, the geometries and stuff, I don't consider myself a custom frame builder. I consider myself, I'll build a frame to your measurements. So most of my customers, in fact, all my customers were bike racers. So they knew exactly what they wanted and what felt good.
So were you basically using Columbus tubing in those days?
Columbus, Reynolds, Betis, whatever I could get a hold of. The supply chain wasn't so good. There was a guy up in Portland. He's still in business. His name is Andy Newlands. And he was the first guy to really import the cool stuff. And plus, he knew what he was talking about because he's an engineer. And he built really nice frames, and he still does. But, yeah, it was hit and miss as far as getting the, you know, the right stuff, unless you were a factory or somebody big where you could buy in bulk. But, yeah, you just kind of got what you got at the time.
So you had a relationship with Greg LeMond. You were one of his sponsors in the early days. Is that correct?
Right. I kind of knew the LeMonds before he got into cycling. And so it would have been 1976, 75 or 76. He started riding with the local bike club, and it was obvious to me that this guy was going to be a future champion. So in 77 and 78, I actually sponsored the local bike club, and Greg was the star rider in that team. And, of course, the rest is history.
Yeah, no kidding. Really good history in our case. Really good history. So when we talk about style and philosophy, and you build after the Italian style, you also build lugged frames. What do you think about the fact that people are building with sloping top tubes and TIG welding, and that is not, from what I can tell, your style?
No, I don't do that. That's more of a production trick to produce frames fast and inexpensive. I mean, I learned how to build these frames using lugs, you know, because that's what everybody used. And I still do to this day.
Whose lugs do you usually use?
The ones I get now, I source them through Giuseppe Bringelli, his connections over there in Italy. I believe it's Walter Pavesi. And, of course, all the top lugs now are cast in Taiwan, either by Everest or Longshin.
You kind of wonder how that all happened. But I guess that's another topic. So you don't really believe in compact geometry. You think that you can accomplish fit. Well, I guess if you're talking about racers have a very specific style.
Well, when you say geometry, to me, geometry means it's just a branch of math. And as far as compact and sloping tubes, I mean, you can make the top tube sloping in either direction. You can make the top tube in a corkscrew shape, and it's still going to function, right? Hold the frame together. But that's another production trick, like big companies that make lots of bike frames. It just narrows it down to small, medium, and large.
Yes, that's true.
And I like a top tube parallel to the ground because it's a point of reference for measurement. Especially if you change out your saddle, then you know exactly where your center line is, and you can set your saddle up correctly, identically to your last bike. With sloping, then it's a whole new deal. But like I said, it's a production trick to make small, medium, and large frames.
Which means that they could have fewer sizes, is your point?
Right, yeah, you go to a bike shop and you go, yeah, I need a 55-centimeter frame, and they'll look at you and go, what? No, we got small, medium, and large.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Although I think maybe we're going to see a revert back to the old style of measuring. So when you measure your frames, you measure them center to center.
Center to center.
Yep. Yep. See, and then that's not even standard in the industry. Nothing's standard in our industry.
No, they have like a center to center, and then they have a virtual whatever. And, you know, I don't know. People come in and they want me to measure them up. I go, well, just bring your bike. We'll measure your bike and figure it out off of that. But, the word geometry, if you're going to do the math or the trig, you got to have center to center measurement to get everything correctly set up. During the Le Monde era, well, up until the 80s, all bike racers rode steel bikes.
Right.
Now all bike racers ride carbon bikes.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, but not yet. So let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Roland DeLaSanta out in Reno, Nevada, about classic steel bikes and the work that he does and has been doing for many decades. So, all right, the elephant in the room just got spoken about. Let's talk about carbon fiber and why you think it's become incredibly popular, and that's pretty much what production bikes look like these days.
Yeah, it's mass production from China. That's the state of the industry. Steel requires some skill, where carbon, basically, except for a few custom carbon frame makers, it's done in molds by nameless, faceless workers. They're not even craftsmen. It's just, they're factory bikes. But, that's just the state of the industry until somebody comes up with another magic material.
What do you think about titanium?
Titanium kind of came and went, and that's a whole other thing, too. I never got into it. It requires special machine tools and stuff to, cut that stuff, and I just never got into it. I know that they've got some alloyed titaniums that are pretty fantastic, and if you live in a place where it's raining all year long, like Seattle, you kind of want to have a titanium frame.
So I want to ask you what you think the magic characteristic is about steel, that when somebody gets on a steel bike and then they get on anything else, it's unlike anything else. What is it that makes steel feel the way it does?
Well, a bicycle frame is basically a spring. And as far as I know, the best springs are made out of steel, unless there's some composite stuff or some magic material now, but it's a spring. And it's got, kind of a springy feel to it, depending on the gauge and the size of the frame and the weight of the rider. But when I first started doing this, like every frame I made went to a bike racer, and they kind of fell into a certain weight range. Now, I don't know on this carbon how they figure out, because they go through a lot of frames now. The yield on steel is when it bends.
Right.
And the yield on carbon fiber is when it explodes. So then you'll have a catastrophic failure. And I just don't know that much about the technology or the material.
Well, it does explode, and it doesn't like to fall down. It's true, you can fall down on a steel bike and get back up and ride it. Probably you fall down on a carbon bike, you don't want to get back up and ride it.
Right. There's been people injured and killed on unseen defects. All of a sudden, bam, your frame or fork breaks and you wake up in the hospital.
Yeah, I want to know about forks. Do you build your own forks?
Oh, yeah. To me, a frame set is a frame and a fork. And it seemed like the carbon fork thing was pushed by the industry and the retail end to get people were thinking, I've got to get a carbon fork because I'm going to go faster. I'm going to climb faster. And it became a fashion accessory. I make each fork to match the frame with the head angle, the rake, to produce the correct trail so the bike handles correctly. But you put an aftermarket fork with the wrong rake and the wrong overall length, you've changed the geometry of your frame.
Right.
Another thing I noticed, I had a couple of customers that kind of yearly basis, their head tube, down tube joint would break because they put a carbon fork on. And the carbon was too stiff, and it was transmitting too much energy to that joint and causing the steel to fail.
Do you use silver braze?
I use silver and brass. It depends on the material, the thickness of the material. Brass is a special technique, and I kind of went just towards silver because it's easier to clean up, and the flux soaks off faster. Where if you go brass, that flux requires hot water and, you know, special tanks to soak all that stuff off. But and also brass, if you're set up to do propane oxygen brazing, that's the way to do it. But I go acetylene. And since I don't do that many frames, I mean, if this was a factory producing 60 frames a day, then, yeah, you got to go to brass. It's just more cost effective.
What do you think about the push toward road discs?
All I know is what I read.
You're not building disc frames?
No, because, you know, until it becomes like a standard. I mean, caliper brakes, you can lock up both wheels easily. Well, the only advantage of a disc is maybe in wet weather. I don't know. I've never used a disc brake.
Well, they say that not just wet weather, but for overheating your rims going down long hills. But then why are you using your brakes, right?
Yeah, well, that's because everybody went to carbon rims. And carbon doesn't dissipate the heat as fast as aluminum. So, you know, if you're using tubulars or even clenchers, you're going to heat up that rim and you're going to either roll a tire or blow a tire from the heat.
How many of your customers still order bikes with sew-ups?
There's a few guys that still ride tubulars because, you know, that's what they got used to. And I don't ride so much anymore, but that's what I use. I use tubulars because I got so many extra wheels and rims. Real bike racers, like in Europe, you know, the big races, they all use tubulars. It's lighter. They handle better. But they're... Tubulars have always been expensive. Just looking at some of the wholesale prices, I go, whoa, yeah. A lot of money for a tire.
We used to think it was a lot of money back in the 80s, too, but now it's even more outrageous, and you don't have the beautiful silk and cotton tires you used to have.
Exactly. Clement Tire Company in Italy, they made the ultimate tubular tires. They had a tire for every purpose.
What was your favorite tire back then? Do you remember?
Oh, I like the 250 Criterium, either the SATA, and I like the Strata 66, which was a cotton. I even like cotton 250s. Perry Robés were nice. Del Mundos, depending on the road surface you're riding on, Del Mundos were really popular.
Yeah, they were.
I still have a pair of Del Mundos that hold air over here.
That's awesome.
And now I think the best tubulars are Veloflex. They come out of Italy. And then Vittoria, and I forget who else, there's a big tire company in Thailand. I think it's Lion Tire that makes everybody's tires now.
It's not like they used to by hand making tires the way they did in the day, as we say.
Right, right, yeah. And to me, Clement was the ultimate, period.
Yep, that's what we sold. So who paints your frames?
Jim Allen.
Okay, where is he?
He's down east of San Diego by Ranchita. He used to be the foreman at Mazzi years ago.
Oh.
And his company's called Cycle Smith.
Yeah.
And he does production work, but he also does paint for guys like me and, you know, other small-time builders.
You know, my husband and I were talking about Confenti the other day. Did you know him?
I spoke to him in person a few times, and I actually talked to him about 3 weeks before he died. He was, I think, 32 or 33 years old. Really nice guy, and he was showing me his new lugs. He was getting some investment cast lugs done, and they were being cast in Carson City, Nevada. And at the time, I'm going, whoa, how could he afford the tooling for that? And I was a little bit envious because I'm going, this is a big time saver over the old pressed steel lugs. But eventually, I ended up inheriting all of his tools, or most of his tools.
Really?
Yeah, fork rake gauges, different bending things, checking gauges, a lot of fork stuff, a lot of things that he made. What else do I use on a daily basis?
Wow.
Yeah, somehow...
How bizarre.
The widow sold everything to some bike distributor, and the stuff that they knew that they could sell, they sold. And the rest, they didn't even know what it was. And a friend of mine acquired it, and then he decided to give it all to me. But, yeah, I use all that stuff on a daily basis.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people know who he was, you know, not in modern day.
Yeah, he did excellent work, but he also worked for Mozzie. In fact, the day he died, he was heading back to Mozzie to see about getting his job back because he tried to do this custom frame thing. And at the time, they were pretty pricey, but the materials he was working with, the sand cast crowns and bottom bracket shells and that stuff, I mean, you're talking 40, 50 hours per frame. You know, the guy, he worked hard. And I believe he only made about 135 frames under his own name.
I think that's correct. I think that is the number.
And I ended up with a bunch of his paperwork. And he was just another artisan builder from Italy that did work for Mozzie and various companies. But the paperwork in there, and I showed this to Mike Neal, who was a professional bike racer in Italy in the 70s. And he goes, oh, yeah, that guy was on my team. Yeah, that guy was on my team. And there were some famous names on there that Cadfente built frames for them, but their bike sponsor would put their name on it.
Right. Okay, so I see he was building not under his own name. Wow, that's so interesting. So you are still building frames?
Yeah, on a limited basis.
What does that mean, limited?
Oh, yeah, I might do 20 or 25 a year, and I just work part-time. And I'm training a guy. My techniques of putting frames together. And at one time I did production work. I did sizes. I did the Le Mans, Team Le Mans brand of bikes. And I built Moretti's for this guy, Cesar Moretti, who was a champion bike racer on the six-day circuit back in, you know, the 30s and 40s kind of guy. And he ended up in Colorado. Yeah, he passed away some years ago, but a pretty famous guy. But yeah, to me, it's kind of a job. It wasn't a, you know, like a romantic thing to do.
If I were to say, build me a frame, Roland, how long would I wait?
Well, it depends on the painter.
Ah, true that.
But usually it's 6 to 8 weeks delivery.
Okay.
And I'm going to be getting two frames today back from the painter. He called me this morning to tell me. But he also does production work, so his bread and butter are other companies like Mondonico and Torelli and those guys.
Mondonico. So I only ever sold one of those frames.
Uh-huh.
And I know who has it. It's right here in Cleveland. I know the guy who's got it. It was really a pretty frame. So here are my silly questions. What's your favorite food?
Oh, I like Italian, especially Tuscan peasant food.
Yum.
Like wild boar, polenta, you know, stuff like that.
Do you cook it yourself?
Yeah, and I have a friend who has an Italian restaurant. He had a restaurant in Tuscany for 20 years. He just sold it and moved back to Reno. And he advertises genuine Tuscan cuisine, and it's real.
Wow. Maybe we should come out there. So what's your favorite music? What do you listen to when you're building frames or just relaxing?
I'm a lifelong Frank Zappa fan.
Me too!
But my new guy is Joe Bonamassa.
Oh my gosh! Okay, so we'll go from Hot Rats to Susie Cream Cheese. Yes, indeed. And then Joe Bonamassa, I think we have all of his albums. That is really, really funny.
I've seen him live twice. Got to go to the meet and greet and shake his hand, get pictures and stuff.
Nice.
The guy's amazing.
He is amazing. We went to one concert here in Cleveland. We've only been to one. Pat Metheny's one of my other favorite guys, by the way.
Oh, okay.
All right. Do you have any pets?
Yeah, I got a black cat. Her name's Jackie O is her name.
Really?
Yeah. She just showed up one day wearing a tag. It said Jackie O.
but no identifying.
There was a phone number, but she came from two blocks away, and she's been here ever since.
I see. She just never went back.
No, she didn't like it there.
Are you gonna go to NABS this coming year?
Oh yeah, I'm going for sure.
Well, I think it would be fun to meet up and maybe, like, trade more Frank Zappa and Joe Bonamassa stories, huh?
I've seen Zappa twice.
Me too. He did something called Billy the Mountain here in Cleveland. It was like a five-hour epic concert.
Back in the 80s, Frank Zappa came to Reno, and he was greeted at the Reno airport by the Reno High School marching band, and they were playing Zappa songs.
That's cool.
With the tubas and stuff.
Sure.
And they did a live interview on one of the local rock stations, and I still remember the guy asked him, so Frank, can I buy you a beer? And he goes, I don't drink. And he goes, well, what do you do? And he goes, I smoke cigarettes and I drink coffee.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I knew he smoked cigarettes, but I guess I didn't put that all together. You would think that everybody from that era smoked something, right?
Yeah, and he was an anti-drug guy.
He was, that's true.
And toward the end, he was getting active in politics. At the concerts, you could sign up to register to vote. That was his big thrust, was to get people to vote.
I don't remember that, but that's probably true. That's so cool that you like Frank Zappa. You know, there's a kind of a resurgence of Frank Zappa on Facebook. They have a whole bunch of new Frank Zappa T-shirts.
Mm-hmm.
We had a big poster in the bathroom of our shop.
Huh.
It said, Phi Zappa Crappa.
Yeah, I've got the T-shirt. He's sitting on the toilet.
You're right, exactly.
Yeah, somebody gave me that T-shirt. I stood somewhere. But there's another famous frame guy. His name's Ross Schaefer.
Yeah, I know Ross.
Yeah, he's a huge Zappa fan.
You know, I was at his house, and I don't think we actually had that conversation. We went up to Petaluma, and we went to the house, and we had a conversation, because Soulcraft is up there, too, and we were talking with him. But we never got to that part. I'll have to bust his chops about that.
Because Ross and Brian Bayless, who just passed away, and the Rock Lobster guy, Paul Sadoff,
right,
at one of the NAB shows, they formed a little band called the Mother Fluxers.
I remember that.
They did a whole bunch of Zappa stuff.
Because they were the mothers of invention.
Right.
Right. Oh, my goodness.
Mother Fluxers.
That's right. Well, what a wonderful conversation, Roland. Thank you so much for talking with me today. I hope you have a wonderful holiday, and maybe I'll see you at NABS. That would be great.
Okay. Talk to you again. Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was a conversation, folks. That was so much fun. Roland De La Santa, classic, iconic frame builder, obviously has ideas of his own. We need to take a break. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We will be right back.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
On Wednesday, December 14th at 7 p.m., celebrate the holiday season with a special performance of the African Children's Choir. Composed of 18 African children, aged 7 to 10, many have lost one or both parents through the devastation of war, famine, and disease. Over the past 20 years, children of these choirs have appeared in thousands of concerts around the world. This free performance takes place in the gym of Kitty City Childcare at 280 East 206th Street in Euclid. A free will support offering will be collected. More information by calling 216-798-7089.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. I'm going to read you a little bit of our news today. Adventure Cyclist has announced a young adult bike travel scholarship, which I think sounds kind of interesting, getting young people into cycling. It's for young adults ages 18 to 30. Explore the world by bicycle. Discover the adventure that awaits you. Inspire others. Whether you are new to bicycle travel or looking to build your outdoor leadership skills, this program is here to help get you in the saddle and out on the road by providing classes and resources to young adults. Each of our two scholarship tracks are designed to support riders of varying levels of experience and cover the cost of attending one of our education courses. In addition to providing transportation, accommodation, and course fees, Adventure Cycling will also hook you up with the right gear to plan your next adventure. Upon completion of the education courses, scholarship recipients will take what they've learned and apply it to an outreach activity to promote bicycle travel in their communities. So there are two scholarship opportunities. One is the Road Touring Scholarship, the Intro to Road Touring Scholarship, and the other is the Outdoor Leadership Scholarship. For information, you can log on to adventurecycling.org and look it up. It's really an interesting program, and I think it might encourage some young people to get into adult travel, which I like a lot. You can also, by the way, support a young person's first bike tour by logging on, and there's a Donate Now button if you're interested. So this was a rumor for a while, and then back in October, they were talking about this was going to happen. And this week, it did happen. Pinarello was sold to the private equity firm involving LVMH. So that's Louis Vuitton. This comes from the bicycle retailer out of Greenwich, Connecticut. Italy's Pinarello bike brand has been purchased by L. Catterton, a U.S.-based private equity firm. The luxury brand conglomerate LVMH, the owner of Louis Vuitton and other brands, is a part owner of L. Catterton. A purchase price was not released. Pinarello began in Treviso, Italy, more than 65 years ago. The Pinarello management team will continue to be led by CEO Fausto Pinarello. Out of the brand's Treviso headquarters, Fausto Pinarello retains a, quote, significant, unquote, minority stake in the brand. L. Catterton's unparalleled experience building leading brands and deep understanding of a global consumer market make them the ideal partner for Pinarello, said Fausto Pinarello in a press release issued by L. Catterton. L. Catterton appreciates our uncompromising commitment to creating the world's finest racing bicycles, and we know their financial and operational expertise will be invaluable during the next phase of growth. So it looks like Pinarello has fallen into what we like to call the golden toilet. I think it's wonderful that they're getting this kind of boost. They have been doing very well this year. I see their bikes and see that they're quite lovely. Pinarello Holdings said it recorded 52 million euros or $55.7 million in sales during its 2015-16 fiscal year. The company has more than 50 employees and produces 30,000 bikes and frames per year. Cycling is, you know, that's a big thing. I didn't know they were that big. Well, we'll see how they do under the Louis Vuitton banner. My guess is they're going to probably try to open some stores that feature the Pinarello brand. So we'll see what happens. This is kind of a sad story. Cycling is losing a young champion at the age of 27. It comes from cyclingtips.com on December 7th. So Australian editor of Cycling Tips, Matt Deneef, spoke with Bobridge to learn more about his decision to hang up his wheels, the extent of the rheumatoid arthritis that plagued him throughout his career, his favorite memories from the road, and track, and what might come next. So the last time we heard from Jack Bobridge, the article begins, the 27-year-old had come home to Australia early, skipping his planned appearance at the Tour de Britain and ending his 2016 season with Trek Segafredo ahead of time. At the time, he told Cycling Tips he was run down and that the body was just too tired to race, but he did not go into specifics. Now that he's made the decision to retire, Bobridge is willing to divulge more. The rheumatoid arthritis he's battled throughout his career was worse than he'd been letting on. This is a quote from Jack Bobridge. Over the past 6 years or something, I haven't really expressed the arthritis to too many people, but it was pretty hard on the body. The Olympic campaign, jumping from track to road and back, forward, back, forward. This year, I was carrying injuries a lot of the season as well. Little niggly ones, nothing serious, but it was part of the big reason I came back to Australia. The body was just tired and worn out, and 90% of that was probably the arthritis. Bobridge said in September that he hadn't yet decided whether he would retire, that he was weighing his options, but in the months since his return, the way forward has become clear. I think since I got back and backed the training off and wasn't racing, I realized that the arthritis, I found that it was a lot less stressful on the body and the joints once he stopped training and racing, Bobridge says. It definitely wasn't an easy decision to retire. I wouldn't say that at all. But at the end of the day, health comes first. I want to be able to, at 50 or 60, I'd like to still be able to function and be mobile and getting around like a normal person instead of thrash the body and abuse it for the next 5 years for sport. So he was first diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis in 2010, and since the autoimmune condition has proved a constant thorn in his side, he's battled swollen fingers, wrists, and knees, making cycling painful. Flare-ups were brought on by hot conditions, cold conditions, and certain foods. So the article's quite long, but it does talk about the TUEs, those exemptions that some cyclists get for things like asthma. I think that in the case of Jack Bobridge, his using, it's called prednisolone. It is a steroid that is often given for inflammation. And I think in his case, that makes good sense. So cyclingtips.com, just look up Jack Bobridge on retiring. So, videos. There are two that caught my eye this week. One is actually an ad from American Express, but the first one is from the UCI World Championship Artistic Cycling Performances in Stuttgart, Germany. I think this is one of the most entertaining and challenging looking events I've ever seen, and I'd like to see more of it. Type in UCI Artistic Cycling Performance on YouTube to see some of the amazing 1, 2, and 4-person competitions. These are, as I said, they're UCI sanctioned. They're just very, very clever, and these people just do amazing things on bicycles that you just don't think about, like climbing on top of each other and riding around in circles and one-legged cycling and, you know, doing wheelies and riding. Just awesome stuff. It's really cool. Then Amex paired Shaquille O'Neal and Wanda Sykes in an ad for their Shop Small campaign. All right, so Shaquille O'Neal, who is huge, and Wanda Sykes, who is itty-bitty, are shopping for a tandem bike. It's hilarious. It's not a long ad. It's probably only 30 seconds. But if you type in American Express, Shaquille O'Neal, Wanda Sykes, you'll get to see it. So the artistic cycling turns out to be only one of three what they're calling bizarre cycling sports in BikeRadar.com. And I'm not sure why you'd call it bizarre. I did not think that the artistic cycling was bizarre. But the two other sports that they did have, I think, are pretty bizarre. One is called bike ball because feet are for losers. And the other is unicycle football because scoring your shins doesn't get boring. So I'm not sure what that's all about. They are all videos if you want to watch them. It's bikeradar.com/gear/article/bizarre-cycling. So on that note, we are off for a break, and then we will be right back to talk with the senior tech editor for Bicycling Magazine, Gloria Liu, on what's on your nice list for the holidays. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
Oh, what are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
What are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. It's been a long time since we've had an adventure in the forest.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
You're right. I should get out.
Yeah, the forest is not that far away.
Hey, Mom!
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
And we are back once again on The Outspoken Cyclist. We are heading over to Emmaus, Pennsylvania to speak with senior tech editor at Bicycling Magazine, Gloria Liu. Gloria, thanks for joining me on the show this week. Let's talk about holiday gifts.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
It's my pleasure. And the holidays are coming. And normally we kind of review like a gift each week. But I thought we'd do something different this year. And it's a great time for somebody else to give us ideas about gift giving. As the gear editor for Bicycling Magazine, tell us a little bit about what you do, and then we'll dive on into some of the gift ideas you have.
Sure. So I work for Bicycling, obviously, and I edit everything related to our print coverage of gear, and I also oversee our full-time test team, which we have we have people located remotely in California and Colorado, as well as here in our headquarters in Pennsylvania. So, yeah, basically test bikes and gear, edit all the reviews that come in for the magazine, and work with our awesome expert test team.
I bet you have some good ideas for us for holiday then. Let's start with indoor, because now it's winter here. We're going to get some snow this week in Northeast Ohio. Tell us what you've got for indoor training product ideas.
Sure. I guess I'd sort of preface it by saying this really depends on, one, how much of a budget you're working with, or two, how much you like this person. So, you know, I would, you know, maybe let's start with a sort of big gift for someone that, you know, is really important in your life. Obviously, one of the keys to training indoors is having an indoor stationary trainer. I would say that the product that Recyclist covets is probably the Wahoo Kicker. It's an indoor stationary trainer, and it's a direct drive system, which means that you actually take your rear wheel off and put the bike directly onto the trainer. which obviously saves you tires, because we all know trainers eat tires. And the other cool thing about the kicker is that it has a connected trainer, so it can talk to your smartphone or your computer, and then you can actually control the resistance through Wahoo's free app, as well as use third-party apps like Zwift. And the kicker will, you know, control your resistance, so you kind of just have to pedal and it'll give you a program. That's a big gift.
It is a big gift, but I have the Wahoo app on my phone, although I don't use it exactly that way. We do have a kicker at our shop, and I know many of our clients do, and they love them. They're really, really nice machines, considering the old RacerMate from like 40 years ago.
Yeah, they have really great like road feel, and the newest version can simulate some pretty steep hills, I think up to 20%. So if you have that cyclist in your life who just loves to get down there and put themselves in the pain cave, that's a great present for them.
Yes, we know about those guys and girls. What other kind of indoor training ideas do you have?
Sure. So another smart trainer, these connected trainers are called smart trainers. That's a little more budget-friendly, but still a pretty big ticket item, is the Kurt Kinetic Road Machine Smart. Like the kicker, it'll give you estimated power readings, and it'll connect with apps. And you can, you know, get on Zwift with a trainer like that, too. You do put your bike directly on it. It's more of a traditional style stationary trainer. So those are my two sort of ideas for trainers. If you want to go smaller, let's say you have somebody who either already has a set of rollers or a trainer, I would say you can help them spruce up their indoor training setup. So, you know, when you're riding inside, there's just a few key items that everybody needs. One big thing is a trainer block. That's a block that holds your front wheel steady, so you can get up out of the saddle and do some hard efforts. You're not going to tip anything over. Everybody needs a trainer mat that just sort of pads the ground under the trainer from your sweat and from the vibration from the trainer. And, you know, get them a good fan or two and a stand for their TV or laptop. But if I came home, you know, and walked down my basement and that was set up for me, I would say that'd be an awesome Christmas or, you know, holiday present just in time for the winter that's ahead.
Which we hope will be mild, but probably won't be.
And, you know, even if it is, everybody ends up having to ride indoors at least a little bit just because the days are shorter, too.
Right. That's true. People are actually riding longer into the season. And I know one of the things that's always discussed is what the right apparel is. You know, layer your clothes, use wicking fabrics and all that. Do you have a really good jacket that you've seen recently that you would recommend?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, the jacket probably is one of the more important items you can invest in for your winter apparel because it keeps your core warm, and also because there's just a huge range in terms of, honestly, quality. So if you want something that's going to keep you warm, but you don't want it to be so wind-blocking that it doesn't breathe, so that you end up getting sweaty and then cold anyways from the inside out. So I would say that in looking for a jacket, you know, a soft shell is usually the type of material that offers that balance of breathability but wind-blocking. One good one is the Bontrager. The men's jacket is called the Velocis, and the women's jacket is called the Mirage. And that's a good one that is at a pretty fair price, has, you know, good breathable wind-blocking soft shell material and a breathable back panel so that you don't overheat. I've worn that on some days that, you know, were in the low 40s nominally, but felt more kind of like high 30s. And then they have one that's a little bit warmer, too, that's a step up. And another one is the 7-Mesh Strategy. That's great. Just a great soft shell, wind-blocking material all the way around.
So do you have anything that you would suggest for the commuter who's really out there in the elements?
Yeah, I mean, again, I would say, you know, probably the most important thing would be a jacket. I'm actually riding right now a hoodie called the Showers Pass Rogue hoodie. And I don't know, have you seen it before?
Showers Pass is a company I know fairly well. I don't know if I've seen that exact product yet.
Yeah, it's great. It looks very much just like a casual hoodie, so it's not going to look out of place in the office, but it's very waterproof. I've ridden out in pretty heavy rain, and it just, the water, you can see it beating right off and rolling off, which is always a reassuring feeling. And it has like a little bit of that fleece lining on the inside, and just enough loft, meaning it kind of sits off your skin, so it has that nice little warm pocket of air. And it's actually one of the few jackets I've been able to wear commuting on those cold mornings that aren't down. I'm here in eastern Pennsylvania, so it's one of the few not down jackets that I've been able to wear and been like, oh, I'm actually still warm when I'm riding to work.
So how much do you wear under it? I mean, are you wearing like several layers, or are you able to cut a layer because of the fabric?
the windproofing is a huge, like, that's going to cut a lot of cold, right, if you have a windproof outer layer. But I would wear something like that with, like, a thick sweater. So, yeah, there's just the other day I wore it with a merino knit sweater, and I was, you know, perfectly warm.
Cool. Well, warm. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Gloria Liu. She is the gear editor for Bicycling Magazine. We're talking about holiday gifts. I'm going to move on to something a little less personal, but maybe. We review a lot of books on the air, and mostly we talk to the authors about their books, but I haven't really talked to anyone recently about a good maintenance manual. I know Bicycling usually publishes one. Do you have one this year? Is there another one that you might recommend, or maybe a couple of them?
Yeah, also, you know, obviously I'm partial to the books that Bicycling, our parent company, Rodale, published. So we have the Bicycling Complete Guide to Bicycle Maintenance and Repair. And I would recommend that. You know, I think it's definitely intended to be easy to understand. You know, we have a lot of, like, manuals out there that are intended for professional mechanics, which are great, but this book is actually, you know, just for riders like myself who are not, you know, super mechanically inclined necessarily, and it's easy to understand. So,
how much electronic stuff is covered in the books these days? Is there electronic stuff?
I might imagine that some of the professional training manuals for mechanics may be updated for, you know, things like DI2. But honestly, the bike industry is evolving so fast, you know, like, it's tough for the literature to sort of keep up with it. And, you know, to be honest, for stuff that's, like, higher level, like DI2, fixing your DI2 drivetrain, or some of those, like, integrated brakes with aero bikes, I would take it to a mechanic. And you're usually dealing with something pretty expensive, and you know, if it's a simple fix, which sometimes things are, a good mechanic can show you, like, you know, hey, here's an easy way to check your DI2 battery or something.
Right, right.
But, you know, anything more complicated than that, like internal cable routing and all that jazz, like, I would just take it to a professional.
Me too. You know, one of the hot topics that we discuss a lot, and it has to do with both safety and kind of excitement and thrill, are cameras. On-bike cameras like GoPro or the Ion Air. Have you got any reviews on cameras that you found especially sort of suitable for just the average person who wants to sort of record his or her ride, or, heaven forbid, they get into some sort of altercation?
Yeah. So I hope this doesn't sort of throw things for a loop, but I was, you know, I honestly definitely see the application for GoPros and on-bike video cameras, but, you know, my personal experience with them, and this is not as a gear tester who, you know, it's my job to, like, actually go and figure this thing out and use it and edit the footage and everything, is that, you know, a lot of people who end up with GoPros or on-bike cameras, like, they you know, figure it out and they film all this stuff, and then the footage just sort of kind of sits on their computer. Because then, you know, it takes a lot of time and knowledge to edit those things. So what I was actually going to say is that I think a lot of cyclists would really actually benefit more from just a point-and-shoot camera, because, you know, we're all on Instagram and on Facebook, and while we can and do take our phones with us on most rides, you know, what you may know from your experience is that you get the phone out, you got to, like, unlock the code, you have gloves on this time of year, and by the time you get everything out, like, the moment is gone, or you're afraid that you drop your phone and not only have you broken your camera, but you've lost your connection to the world. So a lot of people here in the bicycling office have taken to just carrying around small point-and-shoot cameras that fit in a jersey pocket and, you know, actually take better pictures than a phone. So, you know, you can whip out the camera, take a quick picture. It's higher quality than your phone. And, you know, if you drop it, you've broken a camera, but you haven't broken your entire lifeline to the world.
That's a really good idea, Gloria. I like that one. The one category that I think everybody might be interested in is stocking stuffers. Do you have any ideas for stocking stuffers? I'll bet you do.
Yeah. You know, there's always, you know, the little things that every cyclist just runs through and always wishes we had more of. CO2 cartridges. Honestly, I'd be stoked if someone gave me a box of CO2 cartridges. You know, you just end up losing them, right? Like, people are just like, oh, can I borrow one? And, you know, they just sort of disappear from your life, right? They end up in jersey pockets and get washed. And Honey Stinger waffles, everybody loves those. They are relatively, you know, you feel like they're a little bit of a luxury item when you buy them. They're delicious. So they're kind of a treat. If I got a box of Honey Stinger waffles, I'd be really happy. Or energy chews, you know, that's another sort of people see that a little bit as a splurge, but, you know, buy someone a box of their favorite flavor of energy chews. And those are always, like, nice and easy to eat on the bike, too. Like, Cliff Shot Blocks just came out with a new sleeve that's just one long sleeve, and, like, there's 8 little blocks in there. It's super easy when you're riding in a group to whip it out of your pocket and put a couple of blocks in your mouth and get it back in your pocket. So another fun one, another bicycling plug, is we have this new poster. It's the Eddie Merckx Alphabet. Have you seen this at all?
What is this?
It's this interview our editor-in-chief, Bill Strickland, did with Eddie Merckx a couple years ago, where they went through every letter of the alphabet, and Eddie, you know, Eddie assigned some sort of meaning to every letter of the alphabet.
Only Eddie.
Yeah, A was for attack, of course.
Of course.
And, you know, W, for example, is work. And Eddie says, you know, you should, we all get some talent, but, you know, whatever, however much talent you should get, you should always be more work than talent. And it's sort of just a collection of not just cycling advice, but also life advice from Merckx. And, yeah, and it's cool. It, you know, Bill said, as he said, you know, you'll not only be a better writer, but you might even be a better human being from it. And it's just, you know, it's fun. It's illustrated. And for the roadie in your life, that'd be a good one.
That is. I wonder if H is for Eno.
No, it's not. I can't remember.
That's okay. I just thought it H would be kind of funny if it were, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. These are all really, really good suggestions. The only gift that I think we haven't covered is for that really, really, really special person. Beside the trainer, is there one gift that you think anybody would love to get?
Yeah. So actually, my recommendation may be good news, people, because it's not a very expensive thing. But when I think about somebody who's really special to me, I think about somebody who I want to be safe on the road. And one thing we've gotten into lately, a lot of us here, is riding with lights in the daytime, too. Bontrager, their sister company of Trek, came in and did a pretty compelling presentation to us just about how, you know, a lot of people run lights at night, but actually most collisions with vehicles happen in the daytime, which actually makes sense when you think about it, because most of us ride in the daytime. And you know, they were talking about how a lot of lights are great at night, but it takes a special beam pattern for light to be seen in the daytime. They have a taillight called the Flare R, which they claim can be seen from over a mile away. It is very, very bright. And, you know, a lot of us have taken to running these really bright taillights in the daytime. And, you know, it's, you know, always hard to prove that it makes a difference, right? But, you know, I've been riding with daytime blinking lights, and I do think that I notice cars will go wider around me. They tend not to sort of roar up behind me and surprise me, and I think that it's because they can see me a little earlier. At the very least, they can see that I'm a person who wants to be seen. If I was considering a gift for somebody who really mattered to me, I would want to get them something like this and just send them out into the world sort of with some peace of mind that I've done a little extra to make sure they're visible.
Those are really good ideas. So I have a couple of non-gift questions for you. As the gear editor for bicycling, do you personally try a lot of these products, or do you have a team?
The answer is yes and yes. So I'm fortunate enough to get to, you know, test product pretty much, you know, most days of the week. We also have a full-time focused gear testing team of 5 people who live, like I said, in California, Colorado, and here in Pennsylvania. But also, like, our staff is pretty much testing products on a rolling basis as well. So we have, and in addition to that, we have a team that tests products just for online coverage. So we have actually quite a bit of manpower behind all our bikes and gear testing.
Do you test every product that comes in?
Every product that is covered in the magazine or online, basically every product we review, is tested by somebody here at Bicycling. I can't possibly test every single thing that comes in. Yeah, I mean, literally there's so many brands, so much product out there. That's why we need such a big team, so that we can get testers on everything, or everything that we're interested in testing. But yeah, I touch, you know, just what I'm able to actually, you know, review, which, I mean, I would guess probably between bikes and individual pieces of gear, you know, everything from, you know, a blinky light to a jacket, like, I probably test maybe somewhere between 100 and 130 some odd products a year.
Wow.
But, you know, some of our other year testers, one of them estimated he's in the hundreds in a, per year, for sure.
Wow. Well, I think we've given our listeners an idea of some of the things that come across the bicycling gear person's desk at Bicycling Magazine. Gloria Liu, thank you so much for talking with me today. I hope you have a happy holiday, and stay safe out there.
Thanks, Diane. You too.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Senior tech editor at Bicycling Magazine, Gloria Liu, joined me from her offices. We talked about everything from gels and honey stinger waffles to the Wahoo Smart Trainer. Smart Trainer, I hadn't heard that term before. So that's our show for this evening. I'd like to thank Roland Della Santa and that enjoyable, fun conversation, and Gloria Liu for her insight into maybe some gifts that you want. Put it on your list or go out and get it for you, the cyclist in your life. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with a brand new show next week. Remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.